From VOA, Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. And joining me on the program is James Butte, managing editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. On this edition of the program, we continue our conversation with Ambassador Herman Cohen, former Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs under the George H.W. Bush administration, about his new book, The Mind of the African Strongman, Conversations with Dictators, Statesmen, and Father Figures. Ambassador Cohen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
And as always, I'm delighted to welcome my colleague James Butte, host of the popular Daybreak Africa. Well, Ambassador Cohen, let's talk more specifically about some of your memories of some of these leaders, statesmen some, dictators others. Let's go to the former Zaire, currently the Democratic Republic of Congo. I'd like to get some of your observations with respect to Mobutu. You had a very close relationship with him. He considered you, as you said in the book, family. What are your most vivid memories of him and why?
Well, Mobutu was a complex person. He was snatched out of the army. He was a sergeant, and he took over the government when there was very little preparation. The Belgians didn't really expect Congo to become independent right away, the same as the French and British colonies. They thought, well, 20 years, 30 years later. But because of pressure from the United States and other places, the Congo became independent in 1960 with very few educated people. The Belgians did not allow the Congolese to go to university. So at independence time, there was something like 15 people who had just surreptitiously gotten out and gotten university. So they were ill-prepared, and there was a lot of instability. It's a very large country. Belgian business interests were trying to get some provinces to secede to protect their mining interests. So it was very, very unstable. The Soviets were in there trying to subvert various people, and Congolese were fighting with each other. So finally, the head of the army, who happened to be Mobutu, because he was the highest-ranking Congolese in the army, took over the government in 1965, and he stayed on. So he didn't really know much about governing, so he had to get advice. And he turned to the United States, because we were not colonialists, we were not Belgians, we had no business interests in the Congo. So he really looked to us for advice, and he listened to us most of the time. He kept the country quite stable. And between the time he came to power and in 1975, the economy was getting better. He had the World Bank coming in to help him. And he seemed to be quite good about taking advice and doing the right thing. But bad things happened around 1975. The price of copper, which was the main source of revenue for them, dropped greatly, just like it's dropping now. And a lot of revenue stopped coming in. And Mobutu had borrowed a lot of money because he said, well, we have copper money coming in. We can pay our debts. He was buying expensive airplanes for the airline, all sorts of things. So he got into big trouble, had a lot of debt. He couldn't pay it. And things started to deteriorate. He started going against Belgian business interests. And it was hard. By this time, he was in power for 10 years. He stopped really listening to us too much. And he went off on his own way. And things really got bad for the Congo on the economic side. We maintained friendship. He was always cooperative with us. He allowed us to use his airspace, his air bases, and what have you. But in the final analysis, he really became very corrupt and very, very difficult, and Congo suffered as a result.
It suffered, but yet you say that his legacy remains significant to this day.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, look how unstable Congo has been since he left. After he was overthrown by Kabila with the help of the Rwandans and the Angolans, it's never been stable, and there have been major internal wars. This never happened under Mobutu. The country was basically stable, although not doing much economically. And secondly, he gave this vast nation with hundreds of tribes and languages, he gave them a sense of nationhood. You talk to anybody in the Congo now and they say, I am a Congolese, and they mean it. They mean it. And this sense of nationhood, I think, in the long run, is going to be very helpful to that country. As soon as they get some leadership that can make some good economic decisions, that country will really move ahead quickly.
Because it certainly has a lot of natural resources.
Oh, natural resources, very hardworking people, various climates, good soil. It really could do well.
But it needs a leadership.
It needs new leadership, yes.
Well, let's talk about a neighbor, Angola, because we know that in 1989, Mobutu helped sponsor a peace conference between José Eduardo dos Santos, who was representing the MPLA, the one group that was clamoring for independence from the Portuguese, and then Jonas Savimbi of UNITA. But unfortunately, this peace conference didn't hold. Savimbi couldn't abide by it. And of course, we know, thanks to your book, that Mobutu was furious. And at the time, he denied the United States access to supply Jonas Savimbi, whom the United States was supporting against,
correct,
the MPLA, who was, of course, backed by the Russians and the Cubans.
Right.
So just wanted to get your thoughts about those days, looking back. I know you knew Savimbi very well. What were the lessons learned, in your view, from those days?
Well, Savimbi believed that he really represented the majority of the people in Angola. He spoke African languages. He was very popular. And the government, he thought, and many African leaders agreed with that, they were really not very Angolan. Most of them did not speak African languages. They were all descended from Portuguese ancestors. They spoke only Portuguese. And they really didn't have roots among the Angolan people. So Savimbi felt, I am really the real leader. And I remember President Senghor, for whom I was a U.S. ambassador, he agreed with that. He had Savimbi and gave him an office in Dakar. Houphouet Boigny was very close to Savimbi and also felt the same way. Other leaders around the country felt the same way. But since President Dos Santos was recognized, they kept quiet about it. They did not openly support Savimbi. But a lot of them really were rooting for Savimbi. So this gave Savimbi the feeling, I can win an election. I can be the real leader. So when Mobutu proposed the power sharing in 1989 in his hometown of Gbadolite, I thought it was a good deal because power sharing, then Savimbi could run for election later. But Savimbi felt that it was not enough. He wanted the right to run for election on his own, and he felt he could become the real president of Angola, which was a mistake because he lost the election.
Which leads me to my corollary question. You said in the book that the 10 years of fighting after that election in 1992 caused actually more hardship for the Angolan people than the war between 1966 and 1991. Talk about why that's the case.
You remember that after the independence of Angola in 1975, there was fighting between the MPLA and UNITA and FNLA, different groups who had been fighting the Portuguese. And they started fighting each other. So the Cubans sent in troops to help their favorite, the MPLA, which was a Marxist political party, came out of the Portuguese Communist Party, and they installed the MPLA in power. So Savimbi, of course, wanted to keep fighting, and the only support he could find was from South Africa. The United States was prohibited by law from helping him until 1986, when the laws were changed. So he was bottled up in the corner, in the southeast corner of Angola, getting assistance from South Africa, and he wasn't causing much trouble in Angola. The Angolan army was coming against him, and he was able to stop them thanks to South African help and American help. But the Angolan people really didn't feel that war very much. It was only after the election when Savimbi was able to move around the country and put various arms in different places and drop off many of his fighters that he was able to, after he rejected the election of 1992, he was able to wage full-scale war throughout Angola. He was controlling diamond fields. He was doing all sorts of things all over Angola, and a lot of people were suffering because of that war.
Indeed, and of course in 2002, the Angolan army ambushed and killed him. And you said in the book that you had mixed feelings about his death.
Well, I thought he was a real leader. He was very charismatic, and I thought the majority of the people of Angola really believed in him. But I think because of all the attention he received from the President of the United States and various other heads of state in Europe, I think it went to his head. He became very arrogant, and he couldn't accept other people in UNITA competing with him for attention. For example, very, very popular UNITA representative in Washington for many years, Tito Chingunji, loved by all the American politicians. He was called back to Angola by Savimbi, and he was assassinated by Savimbi. And this caused great consternation. Secretary of State James Baker told me to write a tough letter to Savimbi, saying he was very angry at that. So power went to his head, attention went to his head, and he became quite arrogant. And I think because of his arrogance, he lost the election, because he acted arrogant as a candidate, whereas President Dos Santos acted like a nice man who was playing soccer with the children.
All right, well, we know he's not such a nice man, but we'll have more about that in just a moment. Short break, right back.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listener's mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
We're talking with Ambassador Hank Cohen about his new book, The Mind of the African Strongman, Conversations with Dictators, Statesmen, and Father Figures. Well, back to you, Ambassador Cohen. Quick question about Angola before we go to some other countries and memories of other leaders. As I said, José Eduardo dos Santos, he's been now in power, obviously, for so many years. He's not an angel either, not to necessarily pump up Jonas Savimbi. But look, since 2002, there's no more war. They killed Savimbi, and now we're in 2015. Used to be that the war was an excuse for not developing the country. It's so rich, oil, diamonds, small population, large territory. But there's still so much corruption and lack of freedom of expression, Ambassador Cohen, and an uneven development. What are your thoughts about Angola today? Is it where it can be, should be, or what are its shortcomings and why?
Like so many people, I'm disappointed the fact that Angola, one of the biggest oil producers in Africa, in the world, actually, and as you say, with such a small population, that revenue from oil could go a long way. And there's been very little use of that money to build roads and dams and help the agricultural people. So I see things happening in the capital city. There's more housing going up. There's more infrastructure going up. But generally in the country, I think there's not been much progress. So very little of the revenue that's come in from oil has been used for poverty reduction and for helping the people. So when I look at President Dos Santos, whom I know very well, and I've gotten along very well with him, I express disappointment that not more of the state resources have gone into helping the people.
In terms of U.S. policy, are we exerting any leverage in order to encourage Angola to use the revenue for the development of its own people, or do we just not have that influence or not exerting it?
I don't think we have that much influence there. I don't think the Angolans are asking for advice. And, of course, the Angolans are very good hosts to American companies. I think the biggest oil producer in Angola is Chevron, a big United States company. Exxon is there. There's some other companies. So I think the atmosphere for U.S. companies being good, I don't think we want to have an adversarial relationship with Angola.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Ambassador and former Secretary of State for African Affairs, Herman Cohen, author of the recently published book, The Mind of the African Strongman, Conversations with Dictators, Statesmen, and Father Figures. And this is part two of our conversation with Ambassador Cohen about his fascinating new book. I'm Carol Castiel. And joining me on the program is James Butte, managing editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. You can also send feedback via email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Either way, tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Here's a shout-out to Mercy Anyango Marunda from Nairobi, Kenya. If you want to hear your name on the show, send us an email or like us on Facebook. Let me now turn to my colleague James Butte for a question.
Thank you very much, Carl. And Ambassador Cohen, once again, thank you very much for joining us. You met a lot of strong men in Africa. I was wondering, are there some you wish you had met that you did not meet? I want to bring up particularly Museveni of Uganda, your own reflection on what's happening in Uganda today. You mentioned earlier about some African leaders staying in power for 30 years.
I didn't know Museveni. I've had lots of talks with him, especially when I was assistant secretary. The reason I didn't write about him is I did not want to write about people still in office. The only exception to that was Mugabe, who was there for life. So I could not avoid writing about him. But Museveni is quite a complex person, and he came in to office with a lot of good ideas. And he is one of the first African leaders to promote the private sector. I remember his giving a speech. I was sitting at his table at a luncheon in New York, and he says, "We believe in private property." Now, that's different from a lot of African leaders who didn't like private property, who confiscated private property. And he started off very well, and Uganda really moved ahead fairly quickly. And I think Uganda in general has done quite well. They've done a lot of infrastructure. They've done a lot of business. Oil has been discovered there lately. The negative side of Museveni is that he has the idea of the one-party state. It's multi-party, but he doesn't accept that any other party could win. And I think he's decided he's going to be president for life, which I think is unfortunate because the family has become corrupt and also the atmosphere has deteriorated.
We talked earlier about the Cote d'Ivoire and your admiration for Wafwe Boigné, but you also mentioned that what he did in office was, I think, a prelude to the civil war the Ivory Coast had. I wanted to fast forward. Now that the war is over, Laurent Gbagbo, the former president, is at the ICC, and his trial is supposed to be coming up this November. Some human rights groups were saying that both sides committed human rights violation. Supporters of President Alassane Ouattara also committed human rights violations. I wonder, what's your view on what's happening in Ivory Coast now?
Well, the war in Ivory Coast was started by the ex-president of Burkina Faso, Blaise Compaoré, who was run out of office by his own people last year, and he has now taken refuge in Cote d'Ivoire. He wanted so much to have somebody from Burkina Faso become president of Cote d'Ivoire that he was willing to start a civil war, and that civil war lasted 10 years. He fed the rebels. He took care of the rebels. They controlled the northern half of Cote d'Ivoire for most of the civil war. He was a child of Houphouet Boigny. Houphouet Boigny made him president of Burkina Faso, and they were very close, and they worked together to support Charles Taylor. So in a sense, the civil war in Cote d'Ivoire was started by Houphouet himself after his death through Blaise Compaoré. And in terms of aftermath of the war, what they need in Cote d'Ivoire is Nelson Mandela. When Nelson Mandela came out of captivity after all these years of hardship, he said, "We will reconcile, no revenge." Unfortunately, in Cote d'Ivoire, there's a feeling of revenge is in the air. Gbagbo lost, let's get his people. But the fighters on Ouattara's side also committed crimes. They controlled the northern half of Cote d'Ivoire for many years, and they did horrible things. That's why we got many refugees from Cote d'Ivoire here in the United States, because of what Ouattara's people did. I have a great admiration for Ouattara. He's an excellent economist. He was an excellent prime minister under Houphouet Boigny. But he needs to get this idea of reconciliation and get people out of prison.
Well, speaking of reconciliation, Ambassador Cohen, let's turn now to South Africa. You said in the book that you were very impressed by the visions of de Klerk and Nelson Mandela. Why was the story of Mandela and de Klerk so different from the rest of Africa's strong leaders?
I put out the theory. I'm not sure I can prove. But, you know, South Africa was exposed to Christianity for over 300 years. When the Dutch first came in around 1620, they're very strong religious. And the Africans in South Africa just took to religion very well. So after 300 years, I believe that Christianity has become very strong in South Africa. Whereas the rest of Africa, I think it's just starting, kind of, you know. The rest of Africa, they are very strong Christians, Catholics and Protestants, but still the feeling of ancient African religions still there. to a certain extent, but South Africa, a very Christian country. So when the idea was the war is going to be over, what do? We forgive. And I think that is a strong thing. It's very cultural. And I love the South Africans for that.
You think that South Africa is and still can be a moral beacon for the rest of Africa?
Oh, definitely can be a moral beacon. And I think it extends also to Namibia and Botswana. It's a similar thing.
I have a question about Nigeria. We talked about that in the first part of the program. Ambassador Cohen, you talked a lot about your relationship with General Ibrahim Babangida. Let's fast forward today to Muhammadu Buhari, who won a free and fair election. It looks like civilian rule is really taking root now in Nigeria after so many decades of alternating between military and civilian rule. Of course, there's a large Muslim population. We have the North-South divide. Your reflections on Nigeria today and to what extent it can meet the challenges of defeating the insurgency of Boko Haram, of trying to even out the development between the North and the South. Did you know Muhammadu Buhari, for example?
I have not met Muhammadu Buhari. I know of him, of course, and I know a lot of people who do know him. I think this is a very important development. When Nigeria went from military rule to civilian democratic rule in 1999, we were all happy. The military dictators are out. But unfortunately, the newly democratic leaders started an orgy of corruption. Oh, we're in power now. We've got to collect everything. So until this last president, Goodluck Jonathan, very little has been done. And another thing that happened was they developed a federal system where there are 36 states, and every state gets a share of the oil revenue every month. It's guaranteed in the Constitution. Some governors have used that money very wisely. Look at Lagos State. Lagos has become a modern city, you know, with tramways and all sorts of wonderful things. Same thing with Port Harcourt and other cities in the South. But in the North, which is mainly Muslim population, the governors have been very corrupt, and they've used very little of that money for any sort of development. Go to Kano or Kaduna and those northern countries. It's really dilapidated. Nothing happened. So now you have a new president who used to be a president for about a year as a military man, and he was known for being totally uncorrupt. Even today, after being president, he lives in a modest house. His house is no nicer than mine, and I'm a civil servant, you see. So he is the man of hope now. He will eliminate corruption. I have a great deal of respect for the man. I don't know his reputation, and I'm really optimistic that he's going to clean things up.
I have one follow-up on Nigeria, and then my next question will probably be the one we talked about earlier about reconciliation using the South African example. Talking about Nigeria, the 500-day anniversary of abduction of those schoolgirls is here on hand. And so what do you think about the new government now, Buhari's conduct, defeating Boko Haram?
Well, I think they're getting very serious about it. One of the problems of corruption under Goodluck Jonathan was the army became corrupt. Instead of being a professional army, the army became a source of corruption. Every officer was supposed to get bribes and bring the bribes to the commanding officer. So they were incapable of fighting Boko Haram. And that's why Boko Haram gets stronger. And what the army did was when Boko Haram was reported to be in a village, they wiped out the whole village, took care of all the civilians who had nothing to do with Boko Haram. So it became a great human rights violator. One thing Buhari's going to do, he's fired all the army leaders and he's starting again. I'm expecting that they would do very well against Boko Haram. Plus, Boko Haram has made the mistake of attacking Cameroon, Niger, and Chad. That was a big mistake because those armies are very good. And together with the new Nigerian army, they will be defeated. It'll take a while, but they will be defeated.
On the example of reconciliation, South African example, I mentioned earlier about the Truth and Reconciliation report in Liberia, where the commission came out that those who supported the war in Liberia should be barred from politics, including even the president of Liberia. So is this retribution, or you think Liberia should follow the example of South Africa?
You know, I gave testimony to that commission when it was in St. Paul, Minnesota, so I was part of that. But I believe they should not ask for revenge and retribution. I think they should follow the South African model. I remember when Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was in favor of Taylor. He's the great new man. He's God. He got rid of Samuel Doe. Well, she finally understood that that was the wrong thing. I don't think anyone should be punished for having supported Charles Taylor.
In the few minutes we have left, Ambassador Cohen, you also lift out in your book any significant references to Ethiopia and Eritrea. Ethiopia is considered a very important ally of the United States. President Obama recently visited Addis Ababa. And yet, many are critical. Human rights abuses, lack of freedom of the press. Please, if you can, share with us your thoughts about Eritrea and Ethiopia. You, of course, were instrumental in mediating the end of the war between those two countries back in the early 90s. Discuss your thoughts about Ethiopia, its current political situation, and also Eritrea under Isaias Afwerki. We're seeing so many people fleeing. Many of the migrants that we're seeing crossing the Mediterranean are coming out of Eritrea because of the repressive regime. Do you see any hope there?
Well, Ethiopia, after the war was ended and the new government took over under Meles Zenawi, they became just as authoritarian as the previous government under Mengistu Haile Mariam. Fortunately, they had a much better economic policy. They believed in economic development. They put in tremendously good infrastructure. They've improved the agriculture. They've created a lot of jobs. So in my view, they don't need to be authoritarian. They've been stealing elections. They've been killing students, putting journalists in prison. No need for that. They've been doing so well on the economy. I think they would be elected by themselves without having to steal the election. So this is unfortunate, and I hope they will reform. Now, Eritrea also has a very authoritarian regime under Isaias Afwerki. He was a good guerrilla leader, but he was less good as a political leader. But I think the Eritrean people still love him. And what is happening now is because of economic hardship, many young people are leaving Eritrea trying to get to Europe. They're not running away from oppression, as some people would say. They're not running away from human rights violations. It's mainly an economic thing that they're running away from. And I think if we can get Eritrea and Ethiopia to come together again and work together, they split up in 1998 because they had a war. But they should have an economic union, as I urged them in 1991. And I think Eritrea can come back. It has a wonderful coastline, has a lot of minerals. And what we need is for the U.S. government to go back and do what I did in 1991 and reconcile Eritrea and Ethiopia. They're not doing that now, and I'm disappointed about that.
Well, Ambassador Cohen, we would be remiss if we concluded the program without your talking about Muammar Gaddafi, whom you knew, who is, one could argue, at the root of so much of the unrest now in West Africa, whether it's in the aftermath of the invasion to free up, or rather to protect Benghazi. And now we're seeing arms going to all kinds of groups, Islamist terrorist groups who are destabilizing West Africa. Your final thoughts with regard to Muammar Gaddafi and his legacy?
Muammar Gaddafi was an evil genius, and the emphasis is on the word evil. He was truly somebody who just wanted power for himself, and he didn't care what he did, who he killed to get it. He was very nice to me each time I saw him. We had very nice conversations, and I helped persuade him to send those two people to The Hague, the ones who were responsible for the Lockerbie bombing. So I feel proud of that. Mandela and I worked together to get that done. But still, knowing him as I did, I say he was totally evil. Truly evil, and you could see what some of the things he did with women and what have you. So it's a good thing that he is gone, but the method of getting rid of him has caused much trouble. The United States and the Brits and the French helped rebels get rid of him, but there was no follow-up. You have to go seize the arms. Right now, the tons and tons of arms that he collected are going throughout the Sahel region of Africa, and they're going to Boko Haram, they're going to Al-Qaeda. They're going to all the rebels in Mali and Niger. So we made a big mistake. And as one of my bosses in the State Department told me early on, don't get rid of someone until you know what's coming afterward. And that's the mistake we made in Libya.
So much more to talk about. The book is The Mind of the African Strongman, Conversations with Dictators, Statesmen, and Father Figures. The author, Ambassador Hank Cohen, former Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. Ambassador Cohen, once again, congratulations on your book, and thanks so much for taking time to come in and share your personal experiences and views.
It was a pleasure for me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Marty Curcius, and joining me on the program was James Butte, managing editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.